overcoming the stigma of mental illness.
People who have had intense emotional experiences, the kind that get called by psychiatrists mental illness, have always wanted to tell their own stories. And that's a lot what this book is about.
That's psychologist Gail Hornstein talking about her book, Agnes's Jacket.
I went to speak to a group of mothers who had children in the psychiatric hospital here. No one would talk. And, you know, a mother would come over to me afterwards and tell me about their child, but I think there's so much shame and stigma and inability even to share.
And that's Millicent Monks. Her book, Songs of Three Islands, is about the legacy of mental illness in her family, the family of Andrew Carnegie. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. A friend of mine took her life last November after a long battle with depression. She was 58. A brave, talented, and kind-hearted person, Donna Tobias had been a Navy deep-sea diver, a special education teacher, and, in her last years, a volunteer working with formerly abused and abandoned horses. In her struggles with mental illness, Donna had tried everything: therapy, medication, hospitalization, and even electric shock treatment. But finally, the burden of living was too much, and she decided to end it. Depression is, of course, just one of many mental disorders. Schizophrenia is another. We've heard much in recent days about the disordered ramblings of Jared Loughner, and many have seen in them the signs of paranoid schizophrenia. His thinking signaled serious distress long before his shooting rampage in Tucson earlier this month. Loughner didn't get any kind of treatment, but even had he gone for it, cuts to health services in Arizona may have made that exceedingly difficult. And it would most likely have been heavy on medication, which is cheaper than intensive therapy. But can medication tell us anything about the inner world of the mentally ill? Psychologist Gail Hornstein says we need to pay attention to what mental patients say and to find the meaning in their madness. Hornstein teaches psychology at Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts. In the course of her work, she became fascinated with accounts written by mental patients themselves, personal memoirs, theoretical treatises on mental illness, and documents advocating for the rights of mental patients. We spoke with Hornstein in 2009 about her book, Agnes's Jacket, A Psychologist's Search for the Meanings of Madness. It explores the point of view of people who've been diagnosed with mental illness, how they experience it, how they are healing themselves, and how they're working together to change the public's view of them. I started out our interview by asking Hornstein about the story behind the title of her book.
The title refers to an amazing garment created by a woman named Agnes Richter, who was put into a mental institution in Germany in the 1890s. Agnes was in her 40s at the time she was forcibly institutionalized against her will and kept in this institution for the next 25 years until she died. Before she was put in the institution, she was a seamstress. And as best as we can tell, when she was put into this place, she took the uniform that mental patients were required to wear in the 19th century, much like prisoners are today. She took the uniform and took it apart and reconstructed it into a very beautiful jacket with many elegant details, very beautiful buttonholes and flared cuffs and something called a peplum that makes the design of a jacket more feminine. And what's remarkable about the jacket, and why I used it as the title image, is that on the entire surface of the jacket, the inside, the outside, the sleeves, the collar, she embroidered an autobiographical text. And we know from the perspiration stains and other indications in the jacket that she actually wore this jacket. We don't know whether she wore it on the ward when other patients and staff were there, when, of course, the other patients were wearing these horrible sack-like uniforms or straitjackets, another kind of jacket in a mental hospital, Or we don't know whether she wore it in public or whether she wore it in secret in her room in the middle of the night.
And in fact, there were some secret parts even to this jacket.
Yes, one of the most interesting features of the jacket is that the torso part of the jacket, that is the part that you would see when you're just looking at the person, is backwards. It's inside out. Now, as I said, Agnes Richter was a skilled seamstress. She would not have done this as an accident or an error. She clearly wanted only the backs of the letters to show when someone was looking at the jacket. So really the core part of the text was inside, essentially against her skin, illegible to someone who was looking at it from the outside.
It's practically illegible to us today. It was in a very special kind of script.
Yes. The reason I use this jacket as the title image of my book about madness is because, to me, it represents the core conundrum that we face in trying to understand madness. People who have had intense emotional experiences, the kind that get called by psychiatrists mental illness, have always wanted to tell their own stories. And that's a lot what this book is about. And Agnes Richter was clearly one such person. She spent an unknown number of hours creating this intricate text, clearly wanting urgently to tell the story of her life. We can't quite read what she wrote. And that's for a lot of interesting reasons. And the reason I say can't quite read is, of course, we can make out some words. That's how we know it's an autobiographical text. But she used a script, a kind of writing of cursive German letters that was not used after the 1920s. So no one who is under the age of 90 now in Germany, even a highly literate person, can read this kind of script called Deutsche Schrift. But also because, as I said, the core part of the text faced inside, she wore it against the body. It's almost like a tattoo. She used 6 different colors of thread. We don't know why that is. They're very beautiful. It could be just a decorative aspect of the jacket, which is, after all, a piece of textile art, not just a letter, really. But some of those kinds of thread and yarn were worn away by being worn against the skin. And the other fascinating feature of this jacket is that it's impossible to tell in which direction to read the text. It circles around the sleeves. It creeps up to the collar. It marches inside and outside. And it's very difficult to know, as in a fresco, for example, in a Roman temple, what is the directionality of the message?
You're really describing in some way a coded work. And you say that madness is more code than chemistry. What do you mean?
Well, our contemporary metaphor for madness is that it's a chemical imbalance or some kind of brain dysfunction. And the reason I say that's a metaphor is because scientists don't actually understand enough about the details of that chemistry or that anatomy to be able to say with certainty that that's what causes disordered states of thought. So I think it's helpful for us to think, for instance, of something like a chemical imbalance, which, of course, pharmaceutical companies have tried to use as a way to frame the operation of their drugs. No one has ever measured the balance against which someone is supposed to have a chemical imbalance causing their mental difficulties. So if we take chemical imbalance or brain dysfunction as a kind of metaphor for madness, I'm suggesting that a more useful metaphor would be that of a code, like an anthropologist or especially an archaeologist would use in trying to decipher texts or meanings or messages that are hard to read. If an archaeologist finds a vase in an Etruscan tomb with writing on it, the archaeologist doesn't say, I don't know how to read this, so therefore it doesn't make any sense. The archaeologist says, I don't know how to read this, therefore I have to work to figure out what is the meaning of this text. How can I decipher it? Is it in a code? And I think someone like Agnes Richter and the hundreds of other mental patients who have written accounts of their experiences are often writing in a kind of code because they are not allowed to be writing these texts in the institutions where they have mostly written them.
It puts me in mind of Shakespeare's phrase, there's meaning in this madness. You read many patient narratives even before you began this book, is that right?
Yes, I have for a number of years collected and compiled a bibliography of the accounts of personal experience that people who've been mental patients have written. Some of them are accounts of their own personal experience, say in a hospital or during a distressing or unusual state of mind. Some of them are works of theory. There are a number of patient accounts that attempt to propose alternative understandings of what we call abnormal psychology from the point of view of their own personal experience. There are accounts that patients have written that are advocacy documents, political documents, trying to change conditions in mental hospitals.
So what drew you to this study?
I'm a psychology professor. I'm not myself a psychotherapist. I'm not involved in mental health care. I'm a psychology professor interested in how the mind works. And I began collecting these patient narratives many, many years ago. And when I went to graduate school in psychology and I was doing my PhD studies, I became increasingly perplexed by the fact that mental health professionals did not seem to pay much attention to these accounts. You'd think madness is such a difficult to understand kind of experience that you'd think that we'd jump at the chance as mental health professionals to read firsthand accounts by people who really had, we could say, been there and experienced those states that other people haven't gone through. For instance, a state like hearing voices in your head or seeing things that other people don't see or being in states of abject terror or feeling very, very suspicious and frightened by the ordinary actions of other people around you. And I couldn't understand why mental health professionals didn't see these as crucially important. In fact, they're typically dismissed as, let's put quotes around this because we're on radio, irrational.
Crazy.
Crazy, exactly. And inherent in that notion of crazy is not meaningful. But I found exactly the opposite. I learned most of what I understood about unusual states of mind as a psychologist and as a psychology professor from these books I had read, not from the standard accounts in abnormal psychology textbooks, which seemed very formulaic, very stilted, and often did not represent the diversity of people's experiences, and especially did not represent their intense desire to make sense of their own experiences. That's what so many of these books are about, is people's struggle, like Agnes Richter's struggle, to put into words states that often seem to defy a verbal description.
You're listening to Writer's Voice and to an interview with psychologist Gail Hornstein about her book, Agnes's Jacket. It's excerpted from an interview we did in 2009. Hornstein is also the author of To Redeem One Person is to Redeem the World, The Life of Frieda von Reichmann. Von Reichmann successfully treated Hannah Green, whose memoir about recovering from schizophrenia is I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. I asked Hornstein whether Green's recovery was due to one exceptional patient and therapist, or could more general lessons be drawn from it?
Many, many, many people are cured of schizophrenia. And it's deeply distressing to me that so many mental health professionals seem convinced of the idea that this is impossible.
And why do you think they take that position?
I think they take that position for a number of reasons. The key one today is because schizophrenia is conceived of as an inherent biological dysfunction that cannot be cured. even the most ardent proponent of the medication often prescribed to schizophrenic patients will say these medications don't cure the underlying disease. Therefore, according to their conceptual model, it's impossible for someone to be cured of schizophrenia. Now, I think the whole problem there is they've defined the difficulty in the first place so as to preclude the possibility of people getting better. But in the people that I write about in Agnes's Jacket, much of what I write about is the international political movement of patients who have managed, often through their own efforts rather than those of the mental health system, to get completely better from even the most distressing experiences, the kind that get diagnosed with diagnoses like schizophrenia. The fact that they have gotten better is shown in these kinds of patient first-person accounts, but not in the mainstream psychiatric literature. So I think it's literally the case that most psychiatrists do not meet people who have gotten completely better, because they take themselves out of the mental health system. They might write a personal narrative about their experience, or they might come to the kinds of peer support groups that I participated in for the last 6 years, where I met hundreds of such people.
Tell us about your experience with the Hearing Voices Network and what you discovered about the meaning of the voices.
The Hearing Voices Network, which is an international movement with thousands and thousands of patients all over the world who have organized themselves into peer support groups for people who have these kinds of experiences, which have been heavily stigmatized in the culture and which are, surprisingly enough, rarely of interest to mental health practitioners. This is what I began to study. Most people who have the experience of having a, quote, hallucination or hearing voices, let's call it, say over and over again that when they were interviewed by a psychiatrist or they were in a mental hospital and they were given a standard inventory of what their problems were and what their symptoms were, and they were asked, do you hear voices? If they said yes, that was usually the end of the interview. And the psychiatrist would then focus on what medication they were going to be prescribed in order to stop these voices, because, of course, most people who hear voices are tormented by them. It's a very, very, very distressing experience, and most people certainly want them to stop. The problem is, first of all, these medications often don't result in the voices stopping. Medications often result in the voices seeming farther away, but still audible to the person, and often that makes them even more distressing. But most importantly, people who hear voices feel that there is something important in what the voices are saying, even if it's very frightening, even if it's very distressing. And what happens in these peer support groups, which were organized partly in reaction against psychiatrists' seeming lack of interest in the content of voices, in these peer support groups, what happens is that people ask one another very detailed questions about, what are your voices saying? Is the voice you're hearing today the same voice as you heard last year? Are there more than one voice? Can you tell what gender they are? Can you tell what the age of the people involved is? And most importantly, can you make some kind of interpretation about why you'd be hearing this voice or voices and what they're trying to tell you? For instance, people often report that if they have had traumatic experiences like sexual abuse or other kinds of abuse earlier in their lives, that the voices they hear might not be exactly the same as the people who were involved in that abuse, but they might talk in the same kind of taunting tone, or they might call the person the same denigrating names that the person who abused them calls them. And so in a certain way, a voice like that is keeping the threats of the abuser alive in the person's mind in the present, thus terrorizing them.
And you found that people also felt not only that there was a meaning in the voices, but that hearing voices itself was a phenomenon of trying to come to terms with the trauma that they had suffered.
Yes, people often say, even though they might not recognize this at the beginning, of hearing the voices, that if they start to make sense of these voices, if with the help, for instance, of other people who have this experience, they can interpret some of the meaning, that that allows them to work through the difficult experiences that led this very, very problematic state to arise in the first place. That voices don't just come out of nowhere. They aren't just there for no reason. And what's so optimistic, and one of the reasons I wrote this book, is to get across the very, very optimistic message, which we just don't often hear in the media about mental illness, that people can get completely better and that their experiences mean something and that they can be understood often in collaboration with other people who have similar experiences. So once, for instance, to take this example, when someone begins to work through why was it that, for instance, an experience of abuse gets translated into people inside your head screaming at you 20 years after the event happened? Why has that occurred? What's going on in your life now that makes it difficult for you to cope with whatever those early issues were? That developing strategies for coping with the difficulties in your current life often enable the person to stop hearing voices or to hear them in a way that is much more under their control. For instance, the voices are less tormenting, or there's fewer of these voices, or they hear them in certain situations when they're very stressed, but not in other situations.
We're talking with Gail Hornstein about the international movement of people diagnosed with mental illness to change the dominant view of madness. Her book is Agnes's Jacket, A Psychologist's Search for the Meanings of Madness. Now, you went to this Hearing Voices Network, this peer support group, and we should also say that at least in Britain, there were more mental health professionals who were engaged with these groups, but not as not in a one-up position, not in a dominant position.
Not leading these groups, because they really are peer support groups, but there are sympathetic mental health professionals who have sat in on these groups or helped to facilitate them with a voice hearer.
I want to ask you, what was your first impression when you went? I mean, these were among the first groups that you went to. Did you find that you had to overcome some prejudices of your own in terms of, you know, when you were in the presence of people who freely admitted to hallucinations or hearing voices or may have even talked in a way that, you know, typically people would think was irrational?
Well, let me say that, first of all, they rarely talked in a way that people would think was typically irrational, and that was what was so surprising to me. As I said before, I've been to graduate school in psychology. I have a PhD in psychology. I'm a senior psychology professor at Mount Holyoke College. I learned as a graduate student, and since then, the standard viewpoint about people who have these kinds of experiences like hallucinations, namely that they are irrational, that they, again, I'm going to put this in quotes because this is how abnormal psychology textbooks describe it, lack insight into their own experiences, can't take the role of the other, that is, can't be empathic to other people's experiences because they're so wrapped up in their own. Narcissistic is a word that is often used in abnormal psychology textbooks, I think quite negatively about people's experiences. And when I first started going to Hearing Voices Network support group meetings, what astonished me was that people behaved in ways that had nothing to do with any of the things I had learned as a psychology graduate student and a psychology professor. They were extraordinarily insightful. They were deeply empathic. They were extremely helpful to one another and attuned to one another's feelings and needs. They had a tremendous pragmatic attitude toward making sense of their experiences and helping one another to move beyond them. And I spent many, many hours sitting with the metaphoric equivalent of my jaw dropped as I watched people do things and talk in ways that I had learned in graduate school to think were literally impossible for someone who had been not only diagnosed psychotic, but often these were people who had been in the mental health system for 20 years. They had been hospitalized many times. They had had every medication. They had had shock treatment. They had had every kind of treatment that psychiatry has to offer and had often been given up as people who were doomed to be chronic patients for the rest of their lives. And here they were, sipping tea, thoughtfully analyzing one another's feelings and experiences, making pragmatically helpful suggestions, coming back the following week, making more pragmatically helpful suggestions, even though they were often themselves in very distressing states.
In fact, they were real human beings.
They were completely real human beings, and one of the most important messages of my book, I hope, will come through loud and clear, is that even though we often talk about people with language like, he's a schizophrenic, what we should really be saying is, he's a human being who has had some distressing experiences that psychiatrists might diagnose as schizophrenia. But fundamentally, he's a human being with exactly the same kinds of needs, feelings, levels of insight, etc., as the rest of us.
Our guest today is Gail Hornstein, and we're talking about her book, Agnes's Jacket. You know, I have to make a confession here, and that is that I was a psychiatric social worker, and I actually worked for an emergency services organization. My job was to evaluate people who were in psychological crisis and decide whether they needed to be hospitalized or arrange outpatient mental health treatment for them. I found it a very distressing job, not working with the clients. For me, it was very satisfying to engage with people who were in crisis because I felt they were much more open to real communication, to really thinking and talking through things that were of critical importance. But what I found really distressing were the attitudes of my peers towards the clients. And it seemed to me that the way people would talk about them was very denigrating, you know, and completely against the social work code of ethics, which is really about respecting the client. And I began trying to decide why was there so much contempt for the client on the part of the people, not all of them, but many of the people that I worked with. And I began to think that it's very challenging, it's very disturbing, it's very threatening to be working with people who have a quote-unquote mental illness. My theory is that people, the professionals, need to protect themselves from the stain, from the contamination of mental illness.
I think that's often true, and it's deeply distressing to all of us. But I think the most important issue here has to do with the pessimism that comes from a theoretical viewpoint that says people cannot get better if they've been diagnosed with a serious mental illness like schizophrenia or psychotic depression or bipolar disorder and so on. What I've learned so powerfully from the experiences that I write about in this book is that people can get better. They do get better, often despite the expectations of the mental health professionals with whom they work. And I think once we begin to take a more realistic, accurate, and essentially optimistic attitude about what people are capable of, we don't need then to have those attitudes, not only of, unfortunately, sometimes contempt, but what's underneath that contempt, fear, that this could happen to us, and if it did happen to us, we too would never be able to recover. I think once you start from the assumption that no matter how seriously distressed someone might be, there is always the possibility and the real potential for them to fully recover and to learn something important from those experiences, then I think you don't have to have such negative attitudes about encountering someone who is in that state. You'd have the same attitude as you would with someone who, for instance, was in a very challenging state of physical crisis, a person who had a frightening disease or a very high fever or had been in a coma or some other kind of very serious problem from which you might well expect they could fully recover. And even though it had been terrifying at the time for them as well as for you, afterwards, you would look back and you would say, well, we really learned something very important about the preciousness of life, or about the challenges we all have to struggle with, or about how vulnerable we all are.
In other words, you would be able to be empathic because you weren't driven by a hidden fear that you might have.
And that's what's so striking about patients themselves in these peer support groups. I think that's why they can be so empathic with each other, is because they hold within them that sense that it's possible for everyone to work through these kinds of difficulties no matter how long they've had them. That's partly what allows people to be empathic, because they go back to a time when they themselves were more distressed, and they look to the other person and they say, you can get through this. I did.
Gail Hornstein. You can hear our full interview with her at writersvoice.net. Next up, we talk with Millicent Monks about her memoir, Songs of Three Islands, a story of mental illness in an iconic American family. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Millicent Monks was born into one of the most famous families in America. Her great-grandfather was Andrew Carnegie's brother. Monks grew up among great wealth, spending her summers in Florida on one private island owned by her family, and most of her adulthood on two others off the coast of Maine. But wealth and privilege did not insulate her family from tragedy. Suicide, alcoholism, and mental illness were a legacy passed from generation to generation. Monks's great-grandmother and mother suffered from mental illness, possibly manic depression, and her own daughter was diagnosed at age 18 with what is now called borderline personality disorder. Monks's memoir, Songs of Three Islands, tells the story of her struggle as both the daughter and the mother of women who are mentally ill, and how she was able to find healing in her own life. This is a beautiful book, Songs of Three Islands. Beautiful and tragic, I have to say, although it doesn't end tragically. A story of mental illness in an iconic American family. That iconic family is the family of Andrew Carnegie, who was your great uncle, is that right?
Right.
And the three islands are estates that are owned by your family. One is in the south, off the coast of Georgia, and the other two are off the coast of Maine. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that's where you are right now.
We're in the what you'd call a middle island, I guess.
Now, I get the sense in reading your book that these islands are both very real, loved and beautiful places for you, but they're also metaphors.
Yes.
Let's start with the real first. Tell us a little bit about the island you live on now and the one that you lived on when you were a girl. And your mother lived there as a young girl.
Yes, she grew up there. That's Cumberland Island, and the young John Kennedy was married there, in the little church there. And I remember going there until I was about seven, and then World War II started. I have to say that because nobody knows what war I'm talking about since I'm 77 years old. You know, they think it's the Vietnam War or something. So anyway, I was there until I was about seven, and the war broke out, and it was still very lovely, and the houses were beautiful. And then after the war, it really fell apart. And the Park Service took quite a bit of it over.
By eminent domain.
Yes. It was very unpleasant.
Yeah, I would think so. And now the island that you live on, actually that island, the one in Georgia, Cumberland Island, just seemed like an almost magical place.
Well, I think it was my great-grandfather and his wife had nine children, and they all lived there, and it was magical, but I'm afraid it was a bit of a brigadoon, you know, a place you couldn't leave because you weren't prepared for the world, because they had so much. You know, they had everything that they wanted, big boats and tennis courts and golf courts and people visiting all the time and big houses, and they weren't prepared for the world, really. My grandfather, oh, is said that he wished he had had a college education.
Because?
Well, he never got one because he took over running the island.
And then he wasn't really fit for the real world?
That's, I think, what he felt, yes.
And in a way, your mother and you also didn't really feel fit for the real world.
I think my mother wasn't altogether well. And, excuse me, I lived with her alone in Boston for about 7 years, I guess it was. And that was difficult.
Yeah, in fact, you talk about a legacy that maybe even started earlier than your mother, with your grandmother, of mental disturbance. I mean, it's not clear maybe that your grandmother suffered, but there are indications. Say a little bit about the affliction.
Well, I really don't know. It was my great-grandmother. My grandmother was fine. The great-grandmother who had the 9 children. And she ended up at McLean's Hospital in Boston. But nobody really does seem to know whether it was what just, you know, you didn't talk about mental illness in those days. We still don't talk much about it. But in those days, it was really taboo to talk about it. So it's not really part of the family history, except that she was there.
You know, it's interesting. I do remember that you grew up in Boston, but I kept on having the feeling when you were talking about growing up with your mother that you were on an island. So I think here is where the metaphor comes in. Talk a little bit about island as metaphor for you in this book, Songs of Three Islands.
Okay. I'm a TM meditator and a siddha. And in the Vedic tradition, first, the child is with the mother, and then the child leaves the mother and goes to the next stage, which is family, and their own children and their own family. And then the last stage is the spiritual stage, where the elders go into the forest to explore the spiritual life, because life is coming to an end. So that's the way I see the three islands.
Oh, and so the first one being the one...
With the mother.
With your mother... within the bosom of the family. I mean, those, the other sense I have about the island is that it is a place where you're isolated. And I was so struck, I think the reason why I kept on thinking of you as growing up on an island, even though you were right in the middle of Boston, was because you were terribly isolated as a child. Tell us what your childhood was like. What was going on between you and your mother?
I think she became kind of frightening for me, so I would, I didn't get fed very well, and I would lock myself in my room after school, just because that felt safe. It was really scary. I began to think if I looked in the mirror that I'd see her face instead of mine. It was not a happy growing up.
Why were you afraid of her?
She would stand behind curtains, and you wouldn't know she was there. She got very, very angry. She had a secretary who she'd get absolutely furious with. She ended up having the control over me, so she ended up telling me I was full of poison milk from my father's farm. They had unpasteurized milk, and that I was a rape baby. And then she managed to put me in the hospital for about 3 weeks to see if they couldn't get rid of the poison milk. So that was pretty spooky.
What a metaphor that is, the poison milk.
Yes.
And that you are a rape baby. I mean, she wasn't... your father left when you were fairly young.
Yes, he did.
You describe in your book, Songs of Three Islands, a childhood in which it sounds much more profoundly frightening even than what you've described here. You were not fed. You were not taken care of. You were not looked after. You were identified as evil in some way by your mother. Very, very, it just tore at my heartstrings to read about it. And I kept on thinking, where was everybody else? You had a large family, you had a father, you had grandparents and aunts and uncles. What happened to them? Why didn't they intervene?
Well, I did go down to stay with my aunt in Greenwich quite a bit, but it was the war. So my father was off in New Guinea and my brother was in Europe, and my sister would not come home. She decided she was never going to come home again, so she left and went somewhere. And I wasn't allowed to see my paternal grandmother, who was around.
By your mother?
By my mother, right.
Mm-hmm.
Or any of my father's relatives. So during the war, things were pretty bleak.
And after the war?
And after the war, well, then I went to boarding school.
And you say that when you were, actually, first you went to camp and then you went to this boarding school. You say that you always felt that you were a stranger in the world, and you connect that to the lack of love.
It's interesting. When I talk to other people that have had terribly difficult times with mothers, I think they feel somewhat that way, too. And I think very often they become psychic as a way of protection, which has been kind of interesting because so many of them, that seems to be what happens.
Why is that a way of protection?
I think it's a different way of thinking. You think outside the box. You need to do that to survive. So you just think differently.
And when did you first begin to think in this different way and to know it was different?
Well, I was very lucky to marry the man that I'm still married to. It was, 55 years now?
Bob Monks.
Bob mm-hmm. Monks, right. So I think probably that was the beginning.
It seems that, on the one hand, your book, Songs of Three Islands, you express your interior world in a very powerful way. I was growing up as a child, and it is wrenching to read. And yet, you also report in the outside world, for example, in boarding school, you became president of your class. You were in the choir, I believe it was. You were able to succeed in an outward way. Was there a disjuncture between your inner and your external self? How were you able to bring that off?
I think I had a lot of, sympathy isn't the right word, but for some of the girls who didn't do too well, with the other classmates, or also I sought out some of the girls that were spiritual or had, a spiritual background with their family. I really don't know. I think just getting out of the house was a blessing.
And you learned how to be in the world.
Learned how to be in the world. I didn't do very well in my homework there, my work there, studies.
But that wasn't really because you weren't able to do it.
Now you're telling all my secrets. Well, I really didn't want to learn year and year and years after, wars, one year after another, men killing each other, which I've come to feel lately is some kind of a psychosis. I mean, I think it really is some kind of a mental illness that people should pay attention to. Why do we send young men off to kill each other? And then we bring them back mentally ill. Education, except for the literature part and the writing part, really wasn't much interest to me.
Didn't make much sense, because the world didn't make much sense, is what you're saying.
Thank you.
We're talking with Millicent Monks about her memoir, Songs of Three Islands, a story of mental illness in an iconic American family. So here you were growing up in the lap of privilege. In fact, you have an interesting paragraph about privilege in the book on page 52. You say there are different kinds of privileges. There's the privilege of wealth, which means you can, do whatever you want, basically, if you choose to do it, whether you do it wisely or well. There's a privilege of health, a privilege of talent. But for you, privilege was a double-edged sword, I get the sense. Is that true? Was it a double-edged sword for you? Do you think there was something about the privilege that you had, the financial freedom that you had, and, the society that you were born into that turned out to be woefully inadequate to deal with the actual reality of your situation?
Well, I think I was very fortunate to have a family that had some money, because I see what happens with families that don't have money. Their kids are out on the street, especially if it's mental illness. So I think I was extremely fortunate that there were people in my family who had money. And I see so much pain from families who don't have the money to even get their children into hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
So.
But you were also supposed to conform to a certain way of being that maybe mental illness couldn't really be seen or acknowledged there. For example, the boarding school that you went to, that you had to, you had to be a certain way. You were supposed to,
right.
You know, a way that really wouldn't allow for maybe acknowledgement.
No, that's right. Correct. And I was beginning then to think outside the box a lot. You know, this is silly. All us women marching around all day with guns and khaki uniforms at this expensive boarding school, you know, what are we doing? So I think I didn't think the way many of my classmates did. A couple of them.
And then you graduated and you met your husband. You were at, you went to Sarah Lawrence. Is that
right. Mm-hmm.
And you met your husband. He just seems like such a normal, good, nice person.
Well, of course, I'm prejudiced.
Well, you've been
and he
married
puts up
to him.
With me.
How did you manage, do you think, to go from such dysfunction to, you know, such a good relationship? Very so early, your first one.
That's right. I had no intention of getting married either.
You think it was just luck?
I think it was just luck. I mean, he was such a decent person and so intelligent and interesting to talk to. Maybe it's the stars, do you think?
I don't know.
Something we don't know about.
But tragedy did not completely desert your life. In fact, you have two children, Sandra and Angus. Angus is your son,
right.
Younger, and Sandra is your daughter, older. How old was Sandra when you first began to feel that something was amiss with her?
She was in a little nun's school down the street, and the nuns called me in and said that Angus was doing very well and very peaceful, and that Sandra wasn't doing so well, and they weren't sure just what was the matter. And then when she went to day school, I guess the psychiatrist called me in and said, I think you've got a problem. And then we started with the psychiatrist.
And what was happening at the school?
She couldn't sit still and do her homework, and she would disrupt the children, and she'd go into the bathroom and wouldn't come out, and they couldn't control her. And I was having that problem at home and not a clue what to do. Then they sent me to a psychiatrist when she finally went to the hospital later that was sleeping with his patients.
The psychiatrist was sleeping with the patients.
Yes. That's,
right.
That's in the book. Right.
Well, that's a whole other aspect. A thread in your book is the incredible dysfunction of psychiatry.
Yes. Well, now I'm back at McLean's talking with them all, so it's quite a different picture for me now.
Talking with them about the book?
About the book. They asked me to come and chat with them, and I'm going to be speaking in New York with a group of them. So I'm much happier about psychiatrists this day.
So, and McLean's is, of course, the preeminent hospital for mental disorders.
Yes, yes.
In this country. But before your daughter got there, you had taken her to, you know, one place to another. She got an awful lot of different diagnoses.
Yes, she did. And that made it even more confusing. And the lady psychiatrist that she went to was, I don't know, she certainly didn't care for me and thought that I was to blame for everything. But then at one point, our daughter was given the label of being schizophrenic. And I was, at that point, then the mother was the schizophrenic mother. I don't know if you...
Oh, yeah, the refrigerator mother.
Yes, yes. And, of course, that just made things even worse because already I didn't know what to do, and now to be labeled that was just horrible.
And when you were a child, of course, you were identified by your mother as being, you know, having this poison inside.
That's right. I hadn't even put that together. Yes.
Mm-hmm. So this was extraordinarily painful.
Yeah.
Now, through the years, this you did settle on a different diagnosis.
It's borderline.
Say something about what that is.
I think it's one of the most difficult of the mental illnesses. It's one of the most difficult, and the psychiatrists are very not too happy to deal with them because it's very hard. They're very angry, get very angry, and they don't have any medicine yet for them.
And impulsive.
And impulsive, yes. And suicidal. They can be if they're really not well. So it needs a lot of help. And one of the things I hope to be able to go out to is speak about the borderline personality and that it does need some more support.
Well, you know, I found it interesting to read this aspect of your book. I used to be a clinical social worker.
Oh, that's why you know so much.
And for a long time, I felt that borderline personality disorder was really kind of one of those
catch-all,
and one that was, I mean, almost exclusively applied to women, which seemed like a suspicious thing to me. In fact, I think that's changed over the years. And I had also heard, I mean, pretty much it was, you know, like schizophrenia and the refrigerator mother. It was typically blamed on childhood trauma. But yeah. You say in this book, and this was a new thing to me, that there's some indication that it's a brain disorder.
Well, they have found, now don't quote me because I'm just learning this myself, that they have found the place in the brain where anger lies in borderline personalities, which is a huge thing. And they can actually see, if they make them angry, they can actually see what happens, that whatever it is in the brain can't control it. And that means that they probably will, they said in this article I read, that they're probably in 3 or 4 years have some kind of medicine.
And now another kind of treatment that came into being while I was a social worker was something called DBT, or Dialectical Behavioral Therapy. It was a kind of mindfulness, cognitive behavioral therapy, which did seem to help quite a bit in teaching people who had borderline personality disorder how to control their impulses and their feelings.
They had a 3-day series on that at McLean's, but I'm just doing so much that I couldn't make it. But I think they'll have something like that again, so I do want to go, but that does sound hopeful.
And your daughter had not tried that?
I think, you know, she's 55 now, so mm-hmm. I think maybe she missed most of that, but I think maybe she's going to somebody now that's using that with her,
mm-hmm.
because I will get a note when we were emailing. We aren't at the moment, but when we were, we sort of come and go. I would say, oh, it's another dreadful rainy day, and she'd email me back, if it's a rainy day, go curl up with a nice book.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd go, what? Okay. So I think she is doing some of that. And the Linehan.
Marsha Linehan.
Yeah. I think that's a big help.
Yeah, that is dialectical. That she's the founder of that method, DBT.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well, and she also, they call it mindfulness therapy. I mean, it goes under a number of different names, but basically the idea is the same as you've identified, is to help people gain some control over their emotions.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Through, you know, because I would think that it would be incredibly terrifying for your daughter to have experienced these uncontrollable rages as much as it was terrifying for you and your husband, even more so for her.
I think it's just terrible.
Has she ever shared that with you?
I don't think really. You know, we would go through good periods when we would talk, and then would be bad periods. I think that might have been touched on, but I don't think it was actually something we discussed.
And there's been a certain amount of estrangement between the two of you.
Yes, but in this middle island, we have 45 or more relatives who live here. And she lives right down the street, so I'll bump into her in the grocery store or put something in her mailbox and when things are going okay. So, you know, she is surrounded by a lot of relatives here, which is wonderful.
And yet awkward. Is it awkward for you, too, if you're not speaking with each other?
It's not awkward. I don't think it's the word painful.
Mm-hmm.
Painful. I would love to speak to her. I mean, nothing I would like better than to speak out with my daughter about mental illness. But I don't know. I think she's upset about the book a bit, although that's stopped a bit.
Well, you go pretty deeply into things. And how was that? Well, how was that for you to write such a personal story?
well, you know, I never thought the book was going to do what it was going to do. So I didn't really, I just was writing my journal. It never occurred to me that the book was going to be something that would get out there at all.
You didn't think it was going to be such a success, so you didn't feel like you had to wrestle with the whole issue of revealing, you know, things about your family, about your own daughter to the world?
I don't think I thought that way. I think I just wrote my life down. You know, this is my life. And, you know, I think when you get to be 77, it's like drinking morphine tea or something. Things just float by you a lot more easily than they do when you're young. So you I've kind of put down what my life was and how I thought about it, how I felt about it.
And so you did find a way to deal with a lot of the pain, both of your own upbringing and what happened with your daughter, and that was meditation.
Meditation, and I've been, and lots of the family, we've been to this Jungian analyst for some, I don't know, 25 years now. And so is our daughter. She's contacted him from time to time, and our son, and we'd go with our son too, and that's been a huge help.
Why is that? What did that do for you?
Well, it just means that we could all say what we wanted to say, and then we knew it was safe because we had someone there to, you know, to help us.
To contain it. And Jungian therapy, what has been special about that for you?
Well, I like it that it's more open than the psychiatrists usually are, you know, that Jung was a little off, I think, in some ways, and I'm a little off in some ways, so that was very comforting to know that, you know, things that I expressed weren't going to be seen as odd or whatever, because I think outside the box.
And so now that this book is done, what would you like people to take away as, you know, from your book? What's your hope for that?
I would hope that mothers, in particular, I went to speak to a group of mothers who had children in the psychiatric hospital here. First time that I spoke, no one would talk. I mean, I finished what I had to say, and thank heavens for the psychiatrist, because he kept talking. And, you know, mother would come over to me afterwards and tell me about their child, but I think there's so much shame and stigma and inability even to share. So if I could help mothers, particularly in that way, that would be really wonderful. And maybe then that would go over, you know, a little bit to the children, too. So that's what I would hope.
Well, Millicent Monk, your book is Songs of Three Islands, A Story of Mental Illness in an Iconic American Family. Thanks so much for sharing your story with us here.
Well, thank you.
Millicent Monk lives off the coast of Maine. I started out this hour talking about my friend Donna Tobias, who took her life in November 2010. She was the subject of a wonderful commemorative piece in the Hartford Courant by Annie Hamilton. You can find a link to that story at writersvoice.net. Donna, we miss you. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Be sure to visit us at writersvoice.net to find out who's coming on next week, listen to archive shows, and leave your comments and suggestions. That's www.writersvoice.net. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.